I'm definitely against that. I mean, I think these are professionals who have training in how to tell if a book is actually age appropriate. And I am someone who is very likely to trust professionals in this situation. I mean, granted, I am a professional teacher myself, but I am not paid by the state of Pennsylvania. I am paid by the undergraduates of Carnegie Mellon. So I do think that people are really having to become heroes when they just went to school to be a teacher or a librarian. And it's really tough right now for those folks.
I feel like, for example, the American Library Association, by hosting Banned Books Week, is somewhat seen to have taken a political side.
I think the ALA organizations like PEN America, if you look at their public rhetoric, I mean, they are very careful to say that they're against book bans, no matter who is launching it. I know in California, progressive parents have banded together to challenge books like To Kill a Mockingbird or Huckleberry Finn, again, for, you know, inadequately respectful portrayals of African Americans and use of the N-word. So you could say that was a liberal or left book ban. I think that when I look at the numbers, they just don't compare in a balanced way. So at least right now, I would say liberals are not going about the work of book banning and challenging to the extent that conservatives are.
Well, conservatives seem, per my observations, to be a bit more uptight about sexuality in texts.
I think something like 80 to 90% of most book challenges come around the question of obscenity, age appropriateness, portrayals of sex and sexuality. So I think as we've had a real, what I see is real positive movement in having more public gay authors telling queer stories, there has been, I think, a conservative backlash against that. I think there is a fear, and I don't think this fear even has like a politics per se, that your kids might learn something at school that will lead them to do something you don't want them to do. And I know that, you know, that's something I've struggled with as a parent. You know, especially public schools, like ideally they're going to be exposed to thoughts, ideas, authors, points of view that aren't available in a single family. To my mind, that's the whole point of the project of public education. And, you know, something when we were talking before about free speech and rights, I think one of the things that the Constitution doesn't tell us how to do is what happens when my right to free speech interferes with, say, some other right that I might possess. So I do think that we don't have a mathematical formula for figuring out whose rights trump other people's rights. Maybe you could answer a question for me, which is when you started the banned books class last fall, like, what was your thought on kind of the issue and how did that change over the course of the semester? How are you thinking about it now?
I'm from Chicago. So originally I thought, well, you know, that doesn't happen here, which isn't actually true even. And people who are banning books are just doing it because they feel that they can't control their children. But I feel like I did gain more sympathy for the perspective, even if I don't necessarily agree with banning books, I do see why, well, age appropriateness, I would leave it to the professionals, but I do see the arguments for that being a major problem.
Yeah, I'm happy you said that because I do challenge my students every fall to try and imagine some scenario in their life. I mean, you know, most of you aren't really even at the point where you're even thinking about having children. I think that something really changed for me when I had kids. You know, I just saw the education system differently than when I was in it myself. So to imagine some kind of scenario where you might really disagree with somebody who wants to teach your kid something. So I think I do encourage everybody to try to empathize and take the position of, and imagine being so upset about something that you could get very political about it.
Yeah, I think that's a great place to end this. So this has been Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Riona Duncan, and I've got Professor Kathy Newman here with me. We were talking about banned books. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. It was lovely to speak with you.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to PA@WRCT.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Gordon. Welcome to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. Today's episode will be a continuation of the conversation that Riona Duncan and I had with Professors Christopher Mark Jones, an emeritus professor of French and Francophone Studies from Carnegie Mellon University, and Marcy Persine, an assistant professor of classics at the University of Pittsburgh. That has been one of Riona's professors. Here comes part two of our discussion of translation and various other language issues.
Isn't there a sense between some different languages that one language is looked down on by the speakers of the other language?
I think that's historically true, and of course it tends to be hemisphere-based, you know, if you look at colonial history and so forth, and even the way colonial history has translated itself into contemporary social realities in Africa, well, or the Americas as well. You don't have to look too far. There you can talk about indigenous languages, for example, which Worf would have said they were equally as rich as any of the Indo-European language tree. So there's a sort of imperialism which reflects itself in language and culture. In other words, when the French went to Africa, what did they bring? They brought the church. So their schools were pretty much missionaries who were teaching French and the culture of la mère patrie, the mother country, France, to people in Mali and Senegal and so forth.
Wasn't just the French. I mean, the Belgian did that too. The Germans did that as well. The English did that as well. The Portuguese, yeah.
Absolutely. And there was no monopoly on this kind of cultural imperialism, but the language went with it. And now, you know, what is the national language of Senegal? Well, it's French, but there are probably dozens of indigenous languages still spoken, and some in a significant way, like Wolof and so forth, so that the uses to which language is put, in other words, there's the language of diplomacy, which used to be French. Now English is pretty much the language of everything, commerce, diplomacy, and the list goes on. Of course, when I first went over to Portugal, I went as a professional basketball player. Within 6 weeks, I had to give practices in Portuguese. That was not easy. I went back 20 years later, the small town where I first played and where, as I've mentioned, there were no English speakers. And I was invited to a game and then invited to go in and give a little talk to the team. So I walked into the locker room and started addressing them in Portuguese. And then I realized that other than two guys down at the end of the bench, no one knew what I was talking about. The coach was an Anglophone. All of the players, there were three Americans, two Lithuanians, a Spaniard, a Serb, and two Portuguese. Their entire universe was in English. This was in a small town in Portugal. And I said, oh, and spoke to them in English, you know.
It's interesting because, to your question, these power dynamics exist also within individual languages because of cultural imperialism and linguistic imperialism, which I'm so, you've elucidated so well, Chris. But, you know, I think about how when I was learning Spanish, in high school in South Texas, and I was taught Mexican Spanish as the default pronunciation and vocabulary words of choice. And it was not until many years later in college and in graduate school that I was really truly exposed to Spain-based Spanish and to Catalan and to other dialects of Spanish and became aware of the biases and the condescension and the tension between the languages that reflect this colonized-colonizer dynamic that I was very unaware of as a 13 and 14-year-old learning the language for the first time. But the same is even true, you know, we can think about just the geographic span between Mexico and Spain is vast. But those same dynamics might occur in modern Italian, where you have dialects in Rome that are different from the dialects in Naples, that are different from the dialects of Sicily. And generally speaking, the further south you get in Italy, the more derided by the northerners your dialect of Italian is likely to be. And this also reflects cultural power dynamics, because the closer you were to Milan, to Venice, to Rome, the more likely you were to have powerful connections as far back as the Crusades.
Don't we have that in America with the different accents and the dialects of English spoken here?
We do, but I would say I'm not sure it's as bad as in the UK, though, where you have the public school accent, meaning the private exclusive for the aristocracy and their descendants, and then working class, you know, East London accents and so forth. That's quite extreme differences. Of course, in French, you know, you've got Le Parisien and everything else. Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, the French Revolution intent was a leveler. They wanted everyone to speak and write the same way. Well, people don't evolve that way. And, of course, they sent a bunch of people over to Quebec, then essentially cut them off without a dime for a century or so. So they evolved. And now when the Quebecers go back to France, they get insulted by, c'est pas du français, ça. It's not, that's not French. Mm-hmm. In spite of the fact they are native speakers of French and have a really unique and beautiful, albeit very distinct way of expressing themselves.
Get the sense in America that the versions of English that are spoken in the African-American and the immigrant American community are the ones that are really looked down on.
Yep. And in any lower economic bracket, for that matter, too. You point to the South, but it's, you know, there are class-based accents in the South. There are the Southern Belle versus the non-Southern Belle Southern accents, right? Or you might think, we're in Pittsburgh, we might think of the Appalachian accent as a good parallel, where the Appalachian accent is distinct from, say, what you encounter in urban cities of the same space, same geographic space. It is interesting, though. I know, I reset us to the year 100, but the prioritizing and the politicizing of one's primary language, of the language of the colonizer, it's not inevitable. There's this broader attitude, especially in those early centuries of contact between the Roman Empire as a colonizing power and Greece, the mainland, and the extended Hellenic world, or the Oikoumene, as it was regularly called after the conquest of Alexander. Because when Alexander takes over the eastern half of the Mediterranean, he basically installs laissez-faire government systems. So in Persia, he says, you have satrapies, they can stay, but I want all of the decrees in Greek. And so you see the development of Koine Greek, which is common Greek. That's all that Koine means. When the Romans, specifically Julius Caesar, follow in the footsteps of Alexander and they take over the Oikoumene, where Koine Greek is already practiced as the default legal language, the Romans say, well, we can understand Greek, so this can stay as it is. So it's only in occasional spaces for specific legal purposes that you see Latin as the de facto legal language. So, for example, in Egypt, you see Latin being prioritized for divorce cases. But Egypt is an interesting space because most legal codes during the Roman Empire are left in Greek, but all tax codes are still in native Egyptian because Alexander was too busy taking over the rest of the Eastern Mediterranean to rewrite the tax codes. But you end up with this Roman Empire that is a Latin-speaking population for its rulership, at least for the first 300 years or so, who are perfectly content to let the eastern half of the Mediterranean continue to use Greek.
That sounds like a different story than what Christopher was talking about when European countries colonized Africa or North America or South America.
Yeah, I guess you could say it's different. I'm not sure about the economic reality of, but I'm assuming that those conquerors also had in mind lucre, right? Mm-hmm. Just like the colonial system was a system of exchange of raw materials for manufactured materials to the benefit of the mother country. Once they got through all looking for gold and stuff with the Incas and the Mayas. But so there's that power imbalance, which always works in favor of the colonizer. And Alexander was not looking to lift up the populations for there.
Absolutely not. So it's the same colonizing force executed slightly differently on the linguistic plane.
Yeah.
Brianna, we've ended up talking about language as a window into seeing all sorts of different things about culture.
Well, I feel like the thing is that language is inherently powerful, and it inherently carries out power dynamics, whether that be the difference in accents, or and therefore a bunch of code switching, or imperialism, meaning that people now have to speak another language.
Well, the code switching notion, you know, is an interesting one. Code switching, in my experience, just means using multiple language in the same utterance, for example. And it's looked down upon in educated spaces, in other words, but is quite common. In my own experience, for example, in Portugal, it did not happen until very recently. But in Montreal, for example, you walk into a shop now, you know how you are greeted. Bonjour, hi.
Mm-hmm. Both.
Both. Now, for the defenders of the French language, this is a mortal insult, but it is daily practice in commerce. And that gives you, as the interlocutor of the salesperson, the option of saying, yeah, I'm looking for some socks, or je cherche des chaussettes, vous en avez dans ma taille. You can go either way. Mm-hmm. In other words, in Quebec, where there is the defense of the French language, which is often right in front of mind, that sort of flexibility is threatening. But you see code switching. In Montreal, most people are bilingual. And so they will routinely, if they can't think of a word in French, they will throw it in the English word. And then if you get into the arts, I did a lot of study of Francophone popular music, especially in Quebec, rap, for example. You can have people who will use an indigenous language, Arabic, Spanish, French, and English, not necessarily all in the same rap, but
Potentially in the
potentially,
same.
Potentially.
Yes.
And often in multiples. And Creole, too, of course, because Creole is quite prevalent.
So you'd call it code switching when you're on the bus and you overhear somebody in a conversation in Arabic saying, okay, and...
And I think Christopher's very, very right to highlight that the more diverse or the more bilingual a space is, the more code switching can occur. And to Riona's opening point, it also doesn't have to happen between languages. It can happen within an individual language. So this gets into the dialects issue again, and also to cultural norms and socioeconomics, etc. But so, for example, in English, someone from South Texas, if I'm really like leaning into my roots, I might say, y'all fixing to eat yet? And in a academic setting, I would be very unlikely to say that same expression using those words in that cadence that quickly. I'd be more likely to say, are y'all about to eat? Or are you about to eat? Or are yins about to eat? And see, that's an additional code switch, because now I'm taking on the Pittsburgher cap and trying to utilize an indigenous term for y'all, the equivalent.
Well, that's the whole question of register, of course, yes. You know, so that code switching between registers. My experience being a jock, a musician, an academic, you know, and so you're talking to a bunch of hoopers, mm-hmm. There's going to be more profanity. You're going to be, the subjects that you discuss will be somewhat limited, although I always defend intelligent jocks because they do exist.
And jock musicians apparently exist as well.
Jock musicians as well, absolutely. So, but yeah, the registers, the social registers, which everybody knows, yes. Multiples, some maybe only two. They know that when they're talking to grandma,
right,
they're not supposed to swear.
Right. To your point too about the purpose of code switching, the purposes can vary. So Christopher's example is a utility-based code switch, saying bonjour, hi, so that your customer knows which language they can opt for, that there's aptitude in both, is utility-based. But you might be on the phone with your grandmother and utilize a native or a heritage term to refer to her instead of saying grandma. Or you might say Mitchin, for example, which is Flemish, as a tone of endearment. And then that is a code switch that is used for emotive purpose. Or you might use it because you're multilingual and you can't find the damn word that you're looking for in the language you're speaking, so it comes to your mind in Greek or in Latin or in French or in Chinese or etc. But what's cool, what's so interesting is that in sociolinguistics, they've determined that, generally speaking, you code switch either to create distance from someone. So you use a word because the people around you won't know what you're saying. Or you do it for the opposite reason, which is to create a closer connection with someone because you know, okay, if I switch to Creole French and you know what I'm saying, I've just created a connection with you. I've just flagged that we have this commonality. And so code switching is this beautiful subtext of language to operate within language.
So we're here on Forbes Avenue talking with Marcy Persine, who's assistant professor in classics at the University of Pittsburgh, and Christopher Jones, who's emeritus professor of French and Francophone studies here at CMU. We've really been talking about language in the mind and translation, so I thought I would ask if you had opinions about language that doesn't really go through human minds, like the role of AI in translation.
Well, machine or computer-assisted translation as a practice didn't arrive with AI. And when I came here in 93, for example, it was well underway in computer science and so forth. And you could say anything like Google Translate, or, you know, there are multiples that are there which are not as powerful and don't use anywhere near as much fossil fuel to to make them work. I worked in intelligent tutoring systems here with people from computer science. And so the whole notion of creating a body of knowledge and modeling that body of knowledge and releasing stimuli to students based on that constructed body of knowledge, which the computer was keeping track of, which a teacher also does, of course, mm-hmm. But that's not foreign to me. What's happening with AI is the artificial intelligence is able to learn on its own if it's fed. And of course, as a songwriter and a writer, the artificial intelligence needs to be fed existing texts, mm-hmm. which were actually authored by humans, but which ends up causing an enhanced capacity in the artificial intelligence, which it then can turn around and do Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. Not really, but, you know, maybe not Shakespeare, but can do Queen.
Can do a pastiche of Shakespeare
and fool a lot of people. Previously, the computer would spit out something and you'd say, okay, yeah, give me give me a couple hours and I'll put this into a final shape. Now with AI, it's instead of being 75% final, it's now 97% final to the extent that a professor might not know that the paper written for that assignment was not actually written by Bobby or Janie, but rather Robobby, you know, so to speak.
Robobby. I just made that up. I love that, though. I really appreciate your point, especially about how generative AI and language corpus tools are by nature of how they are constructed. Machines designed for plagiarizing, right? They have to be fed something created by humans at some point in order to create something that is new, but all the parts are old. So in that sense, what ChatGPT or any of these AI tools do is they give you a quilt rather than a brand new fabric. And what humans can do with language is create a new fabric. That doesn't mean the quilt's not useful. And it doesn't mean that there's not, you know, potentially good purposes for AI, too, although your point about the fossil fuels and the energy consumption is also very on the nose, because it's deeply alarming. In learning languages, if you are not thrust into a space of immersion, the fear of failure is such an obstacle. You know, to walk into even, like, Gabby et Jules and order in French in Pittsburgh is very challenging and frightening, but to go on Duolingo and speak into a mic and have a bot respond to you in what feels like more or less canned French, a conversation you might drill and practice until you know it, that can overcome the fear of failure. So, you know, generative AI is kind of regenerative rather than generative, to your point, but there are definitely some uses to it that feel less destructive, but there's also no actual originality to it as it exists right now.
Well, that's a good point, though, that it can assist people in learning the language or getting you a rough translation that you can get a native speaker to help you sort it out so you haven't offended anybody in that language.
Absolutely. It's a good starting point or a good intermediary for sure. In the same way that Google Translate can be a very useful intermediary to start with. Mm-hmm. So, but you also might get some confused looks when you start speaking French in the form of Voltaire, because Voltaire is, of course, copyright free. There might be some lingering aspects of it in ChatGPT that, you know, just surface from time to time.
What about the global media? How's that affecting all the current languages?
Well, I also consume media. Just because my work is in the ancient world doesn't mean I'm dead. so, you know, I do still, you know, watch, you know, Miyazaki films or K-dramas, or as you see globalization occur and more and more and more materials in their original languages available, Turkish dramas. Oh my God, amazing. It's easier to put yourself into spaces of immersion where, you know, you can turn on the subtitles. But eventually you might be doing the dishes while you're watching your Turkish drama and realizing that, oh, I actually don't need to read these English subtitles as much as I thought that I did, because I've been binge watching 5 seasons of historic romance that's all in Turkish.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have to have the subtitles for those Hindi dramas I'm watching.
I guess you haven't watched enough.
Yeah, that's right.
This is me empowering you to watch more.
Just watch more, Richard.
Well, I mean, it's interesting to think back. I mean, remember, how old is the internet?
Mm.
And how old is the World Wide Web? Not that old. Older than you are. Okay. But just barely, right? I mean, you know, the fact is, we're not talking Roman Empire here. We're talking very recent history. And one of the main concerns outside of Anglo-Saxon spaces was that the World Wide Web and the internet were going to be English, you know, and it was going to be another example of cultural and linguistic imperialism. And now that has not turned out to be the case, although there's still probably a predominance of English interaction, right? Even international, between spaces who don't actually speak English. And of course, speaking, learning a language via media, that's not an easy way to go, because it's never easy to do that, but it is certainly feasible.
You know, something that we've sort of been circling around, and I'd love to pick everyone's brain about, is the role of education in the way that we prioritize language. You know, there are languages that we predominantly use in classrooms, and there are languages that are predominantly spoken in households or in churches or in community centers or in, you know, gatherings that are all elders or all women. And these sort of different spaces activate different power dynamics. So one of the reasons why English has this almost chokehold on Americans' linguistic capacity is because English is taught as the de facto language in every public school in the country.
But of course, in North America, Quebec is the counterexample, where math and science and history and so forth are taught in French.
Yes.
And yet they're constantly battling against the wave of English.
I get the sense that even by the time my son, who's in his mid-30s, by the time he was in high school in America, languages were devalued, and people were only taking them because they had to take 2 years to have on their application to a four-year college.
Clearly, the value of language has shifted from my youth to today. Because the value of language, you could say, if I had actually been a Portuguese speaker, I could have gone right in, made myself, I'm remembered for having integrated myself into Portuguese life. That was that massive effort with almost no preparation. Today, what would be the value of arriving with decent Portuguese? The Portuguese would speak to you in English. In France, I used to take students to a summer program. We'd arrive in Paris, and I'd say, hey, go get a coffee. We'll meet back here and take the train out to Strasbourg. They'd come back in tears because the waitress had insulted their French in French. Mm-hmm. Now that same waitress would have spoken to them in English. They would have had no opportunity even to be insulted, you know. So that is a huge difference. And you speak of educationally. Well, how do you get that immersion experience if you're coming from an Anglophone environment? If you're coming from the University of Pittsburgh, you're coming from Carnegie Mellon, and you're going to a major European capital, people will speak to you in English. Mm-hmm. The moment they hear an accent.
I had a friend recently who studied abroad in France, and she didn't speak a lick of French while she was there. She said the only thing she had to be careful was in the line to the club. Mm-hmm. If she spoke English, she might get turned away. But if she had her friends without accents speak, then she could get in and continue living French free.
I mean, to a certain extent, that's a classic story where the American kids go over and they all hang around in a cloud and just speak to each other and don't actually get any immersion experience whatsoever. But that was a lot harder to do even 20 years ago or so.
Although I do also wonder, I am just as prone to this as anyone else, so I promise I'm not pointing fingers, but with the rise of travel influencers on Instagram sending us to further and further obscure places off the beaten track, as it were, you know, I feel like it might be difficult to speak French in Paris, but it might be difficult not to speak French if you are outside of one of these major metropolitan spaces in France. And, you know, to circle back to the question of what the value of these languages are and learning second and third and fourth languages, you know, we could talk about, you know, the ways in which, say, you know, learning computer coding helps your brain develop different ways, new wrinkles, as I like to put it.
Or Christopher and I would say learning to play music develops
exactly,
different things.
Exactly. Or learning mathematics, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we all have calculators in our phones. Why do we need to learn basic multiplication rules? Well, it helps your brain develop, and it helps you hold different forms of critical thinking. And that's kind of getting on the higher tier of pedagogical reasoning for why languages are important. But there's also this fact that, you know, as much as the U.S. seems like a monolinguistic space, and as much as English is a lingua franca, there will always be people in the world you can't speak to unless you reach out and try to learn at least hello, bonjour, you know, ni hao, whatever language it is. And maybe that's your grandmother. Maybe that's your aunt. Maybe that's, you know, the person sitting next to you on the train who's reading a book that looks really interesting. Perhaps, you know, having these tools at our fingertips that can give us shorthands for translations can make, you know, those moments more approachable without the language learning. But I think the language learning is still important so that you know how to use the tools, know what is the appropriate way to implement the tools. Yeah, it's such a good question.
This has just been an amazing conversation. Thank you so much, Marcy Person from Pitt and Christopher Mark Jones from CMU.
Well, thank you so much for having us.
It was an utter joy. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Brad Keselowski, driver of the number 2 Discount Tire Ford Mustang. If there's one thing I've learned after years on the track, it's that having the right amount of pressure in your tires can make or break performance. Properly inflated tires are essential to the health of your car and to keep you driving safely. Check your tire pressure once a month, especially before road trips, or stop by your neighborhood tire retailer for help.
A message from the U.S. Tire Manufacturers Association.
if you're outside of our coverage area, remember, you can listen to WRCT online. Live streaming available at www.wrct.org. WRCT Pittsburgh. You have no excuse not to listen.
Every year, over 1 million fires burn in America. Fortunately, firefighters are on the job, saving life and property, and you can be a part of it. 7 out of 10 firefighters and emergency responders are volunteers. There's no typical firefighter. Anyone can volunteer to serve their community. Volunteering as a first responder is really about having the heart and drive to make a difference where it's needed most. Your community needs you. Are you ready to answer the call? Learn more and find local volunteer opportunities at makemeafirefighter.org.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine. Milner, pot of thieves, wild cord on my sleeve, thick heart of stone, my sins my own, they belong to me, me. People say beware, but I don't care. The words are just rules and regulations to me, me. I walk in a room, you know I look so proud. I'm moving.
smoker. Woo! Cook it out, baby, daddy! I just come back from Minneapolis, where I just beat Vern Gagne and Dick the Bruiser, daddy. They know it. You can bring on Haystack Balloon, Eric Bloom. I don't care who you bring here, daddy. Rainbow, Strobo, they're all going under the thunder of Manitoba.
Minority rule is a uniquely American problem. In no other established democracy can partisan minorities thwart electoral majorities as consistently or as consequentially as in the United States. So other democracies around the world have become more democratic over the last century, eliminating 18th and 19th century institutions that allowed minorities to systematically thwart majorities. Only the United States retained most of its pre-democratic institutions. We need to democratize American democracy.
That's Stephen Levitsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Stephen Levitsky on tyranny of the minority. The United States is moving toward a multiracial society, but that demographic development has sparked an authoritarian political backlash. Powerful forces like things just the way they are. Our political system makes the U.S. vulnerable to minority rule. Perhaps the most undemocratic mechanism enabling minority rule is the antiquated Electoral College. No other country has one. The Electoral College has given the presidency to a candidate that received fewer votes multiple times. Most recently, in 2016, Donald Trump was elected president, even though Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. It almost happened again in 2020, where a shift of a few thousand votes would have given the White House to Trump, even though Joe Biden got 7 million more votes. Our guest today is Stephen Levitsky. He's professor of government at Harvard. He's the co-author of How Democracies Die and Tyranny of the Minority. He spoke at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana in December 2023. And now, Stephen Levitsky.
The United States is experiencing what regime scholars call democratic backsliding. All leading global democracy indices register a decline for the United States since 2016 or 17. Just to take one example, Freedom House has a global freedom index, which scores all countries annually from a low of zero, North Korea, to a high of 100. A decade ago, the United States received a score of 92 out of 100, which put the U.S. roughly on par with the U.K., Japan, Canada, Germany. Today, the U.S. score is 83. That's tied with Romania and below Argentina. Now, that may seem shocking to you, but when you have widespread efforts to make it harder to vote, when you have violent threats against election workers and elected officials, and when you have an attempt by an incumbent president to overturn an election, you fall to the point where Freedom House considers you less democratic than Argentina. Now, this wasn't supposed to happen. Political scientists have discovered two seemingly rock-solid facts about democracies. First of all, rich democracies never die. The wealthiest democracies ever to break down, Argentina and Hungary, both had a per capita GDP of about $17,000 in today's dollars. The U.S. is four times richer than that. Second seemingly rock-solid fact about democracies is that old democracies never die. No democracy over the age of 50 is ever broken down. Even if we date the birth of our democracy at 1965, when we achieved full suffrage, U.S. democracy was over 50 when Donald Trump was elected. So we ought to be safe, but we're not. And we argue that the United States is undergoing an unprecedented transition, an historic transition, a transition to a multiracial democracy in which a previously dominant group loses its dominant status.